keep those Bibles open, grab your outlines, and then what I want you to do is to turn to someone near you, but not your spouse, if that's who's sitting near you. And I want you to turn around and I want you just to talk for about 30 seconds about your idea of a perfect world. How would you describe a perfect world? Maybe it's just things that immediately spring to your head about what you want to see fixed in this world, or it might be just dreams that you have about that, but you've got about 30 seconds. Turn to someone near you, but not your spouse, and quickly share some ideas. Okay. Come on, shouldn't take you longer than 30 seconds to work out what a perfect world should be like. Some ideas. Yell them out. Everyone living in harmony. That sounds like a pop song. No. Thank you, Brenda. That's not a criticism. Trev.
No teenagers.
Ooh. Spoken like a dad. Liz. Share our resources with everyone. That's what Margaret was praying for, wasn't it? Yes? No evil. Oh, that's a biggie. Sue? Okay, yes. Actually, I don't care about the tidy rooms. As long as the door is shut, I don't mind. Any others?
Unity.
No discrimination. Okay. Some good diverse ideas there. Seems to me that in the last 100 years or so, maybe even a bit longer, in the Western world, we've had this idea that we're getting better, that we're working towards maybe not a perfect world, but a really better world of some kind. I guess that happened perhaps especially early in the 20th century as science made progress, medical science in particular, as things like antibiotics were discovered, big things like that. There was this idea, wasn't there, that was born that science will find the answer to all of our problems, that we'll educate ourselves out of sort of the situations that humans find themselves in. The First World War was the war to end all wars, wasn't it, supposedly? That we would somehow make progress, the world would become a dramatically better place, if not a perfect place. But it seems to me of recent years that's changed, and that optimism has been replaced by cynicism or apathy, that things don't seem to be improving in the way that perhaps we once hoped, and that the problems with the world just seem to be outstripping our ability to fix them. Even scientists, there's already talk that, our current weather conditions are all due to climate change. And if you want to be depressed, go and see that new disaster movie, The Day After Tomorrow, where, there seems to be no solution to such things. So this concept of some kind of utopian society, or even something that's leaning towards that, has just rapidly faded. And I want to suggest to you that perhaps at least part of that reason is that when you look at the selection of world leaders that we have, people who are either literally leaders of countries or very influential people on the world stage, no one world leader, not even a group of them together, would seem to have the qualities needed to bring anything approaching perfection to this world. In one sense, of course, that cynicism is well-founded, at least if it is based on the ideas that us humans can find solution to all of our problems. But here's where us Christians can actually have some serious input into the discussion. Because as we've just heard, if you are following that reading, the Bible very definitely speaks of a perfect world. Not just a sort of an idea, but a reality. And the key to that perfect world is a perfect ruler. Now, if you've been reading through Isaiah, you would have come to chapter 9, and you will have read of that ruler already in verses 6 and 7 of chapter 9. You can quickly turn back and have a squiz. It'll be a familiar passage to most of you, I would guess, because we won't stop and read it now, because it's a passage we often read around Christmas time. And we meet that same ruler from those verses here again in chapter 11. And we learn a lot more here about the extraordinary nature of this ruler and of the impact that he'll have on our world. Let's see what we can dig up about it. If you're following on the outline, we're up to 2A near the bottom of page 1. Now last week we saw God's judgment on the house of David, on Judah, largely because of the unbelief of Ahaz, the king of the time. We were reminded of the degree of rebellion and corruption in that nation, with the king, of course, Ahaz, being as guilty as the rest, if not more so, because of his failure to lead people in obedience to God. And that judgment was pronounced, and in a historical sense, of course, though that judgment didn't happen quite immediately, but eventually it did under God's hand when the Babylonians swept in and almost trashed Judah totally. That was the physical way in which that prophecy, that judgment was meted out. But God's graciousness and his purpose, of course, we know, allowed a remnant to remain, including some who would return from exile in Babylon in due course. And this remnant is the stump that we read of in verse 1 of chapter 11. And it's from this stump that a shoot will grow. Now just note a couple of things about that shoot. First of all, we're told the shoot will grow from the stump of Jesse. Who remembers who Jesse was? David's father. Yeah, exactly, that's right. So rather than speaking of David, as often is the case, isn't it? Rather than getting implying all the issues to do with kings and their own arrogance and their own imperfections and all the issues to do with that, Isaiah takes us back to the origins of King David. That is, he takes us back beyond Jerusalem, the seat of power, and goes back to Bethlehem, and all the way back to 1 Samuel 16 and the highly unlikely anointing of that little shepherd boy, David, to the throne. So what Isaiah is doing in this very early bit is pointing us to God's very clear agenda as to who he appoints as his leaders and his rulers. But what is to stop this leader, this ruler, turning bad like all the others, like so many cases? Even David, even the great King David, we know, fell badly on more than one occasion. What's to stop this ruler doing the same and stuffing things up? Well, it's because this ruler is very different. Verse 2 tells us that he is qualified and equipped to rule by the Spirit of God. And the description, in fact, of those qualifications, if you like, is sevenfold, and the emphasis of those descriptions is all on wisdom and authority. Have a look at them there. You can see them. Let me open my Bible there. All the way through verse 2 and down into verses 3 and 4 as well, and 5. And the detail of this description of the work of God's Spirit in this ruler gives us a big clue that we are actually to regard this ruler as perfect. We're to regard this ruler being described here as perfect. So don't go looking for him on the next federal election voting forms, will you? Because you won't find him there. He's not going to be an option to vote into power whenever we get to vote. Now, in a minute, we're going to take a closer look at some of the qualities that this ruler has by God's Spirit. But first, let's have a look just at verses 2 and 3 at a couple of other aspects of there, especially verse 3. We sometimes have a strange idea of what makes a person wise, don't we? In fact, I would go further and say that that our culture today doesn't really value wisdom as a personal quality. People don't elect other people to public office, for example, on the grounds of wisdom. Usually it's the hip pocket effect, isn't it? The so-called Generation X values experience more than wisdom, and so many of them indulge in distinctly unwise activity, preferring that immediate buzz to the long-term effects or issues. Older people, who on balance, you can say, well, they've probably gained a degree of wisdom just from their life experience, are generally not valued in our culture any longer. They're often retired early, they're put out to pasture, rather than being encouraged to pass on their wisdom to others. But note the focus on wisdom in verses 2 and 3, and especially notice the key to gaining wisdom according to Isaiah, which is the fear of the Lord. Now let's be straight on what that means. Fear in this sense doesn't mean being scared in the way that we use fear. We tend to use fear in a negative way. Fear is not a good thing, we say. If someone fears another person, it's generally not a healthy sort of sign of a good relationship. But here it's different. It's tied up here with ideas of reverence for God and of a believer's, I guess, apprehension of the living God, a coming to grips with the nature of God and his qualities and his characteristics, an understanding of just how mighty and how enormous and how awesome God is. But this perfect ruler will be wise because he is given the Spirit of the Lord and therefore delights in the fear of the Lord. And his close relationship with God is actually the source of his wisdom and his authority. And this is, of course, totally like any other human. Totally like any other human ruler or leader, that's for sure. But if this world is to have any hope, then this is the ruler that we need. Okay, so let's explore what this ruler's rule will be like as we look at verses 2 to 4 and some of those qualities that the Spirit of God gives this person, this ruler. Looking at insight in verses 2 and 3, he's happily going to apply his God-given wisdom to his rule. Now, anyone who's been a parent here will know that one of the roles you have to exercise as a parent is that of referee. How often you have to do that depends on the number of children and probably how big your house is, I suspect, and their age and stage. But there are times, of course, even as a parent, where it's impossible to referee fairly, because even if you see the whole dispute take place, you still can't judge people's attitudes and motivations of the people who are taking part in the dispute. But with the Spirit of wisdom and understanding and knowledge, this ruler in Isaiah 11 has the capacity to see things as they really are, under the surface, deep in our hearts. So this ruler has real insight. And also, in verses 4 and 5, this ruler is able to bring justice. This extraordinary ruler is able to bring justice, fairness and equality to the needy, to the poor and to the oppressed. Now my guess is that we tend to actually put that sort of thinking very much out there and away from our own sort of experience and lives. We can all name world leaders who we could say are guilty of oppressing their people in extreme ways. Wasn't that one of the justifications for going into Iraq? Was to remove Saddam Hussein, a great and terrible oppressor. But you know, even here in Australia, even on the local front, is this not one of the debate points being thrown around with the looming federal election? Many people rightly see great inequality in the way that genuinely needy, poor and oppressed people are treated in our society, and are deeply unhappy with the way that successive governments have failed to address the question. So these issues of justice for the needy, the poor and the oppressed are very real ones. And we should certainly long for the day when this ruler of Isaiah 11 is in control and is metering out this real justice for those who are in need of it. But let me say that we mustn't use that day at some point in the future as an excuse to sit on our hands and do nothing in the meantime. We could do a lot worse than to base our vote in the next election based on issues of justice for those who are genuinely poor and struggling in our society. Well, this rule is also going to bring judgment on the wicked and the oppressors. Verse 4b, second half of verse 4. And his great might will bring to an end evil and justice and injustice, showing that he is indeed going to be a powerful ruler. A powerful ruler. But the description here is again far more than just that of a mere mortal. because the power of his word and breath reminds us of the work of creation, doesn't it? How did God create? He spoke, and it happened. And so the same might which brought the world into existence will now bring it to judgment. That's a pretty scary thought if you think on that for a moment. But it's essential, isn't it, to a perfect world. It's essential that evil is destroyed. Someone said that. Someone said that all evil be gone. Well, that's exactly what's got to happen in a perfect world. Evil's got to be dealt with. And the restoration of justice to the oppressed put in place. So this requires a mighty ruler filled with the Spirit of the Lord. Now, let me ask you, are you in awe of this ruler yet? Is the picture painted here of someone that really makes you stand back and go, wow? I hope it is. I hope you are. Let's move on in the passage and see then what kind of world this ruler is going to rule over. What are going to be the characteristics of the world that this person will rule over? And in verses 6 to 9, we've got a description by Isaiah of the impact or the results of this rule. And it's truly a picture of a perfect world. Let's tease out some of the characteristics of it. It's painted as a paradise, isn't it? That whole dog-eat-dog, you know, violent, so-called natural world that we see played out both on the TV news every night, but also in nature documentaries, is being replaced here. Have you noticed how, I don't know if you watch nature docos very much, I do, I suppose, fairly frequently. You notice how they're getting much more gritty and real, and they're not sort of editing out the images of the hunter tearing the prey to pieces, you know, anymore. Perhaps it's sort of just the way TV's going. But we're told that that's all right to show that because it's the natural world. It's the way things happen. It's the way things are supposed to be. Well, it's not. It's not actually, it may be the natural world the way it exists at the moment, but that's not the way it's meant to be. That reality is going to be replaced with a picture of astounding peace and tranquility. In these verses 6 through 9, we've got a description of what is really the Garden of Eden, once again, where the most vulnerable creatures, currently the most vulnerable creatures, are dwelling safely alongside what are at the moment the most violent and destructive. It's quite a picture, isn't it? And it goes on. Children come into the scene. There's more going on here behind the scenes than just this sort of picture of an idyllic paradise. Because in verses 6 and 8, the children and the snake should cast our minds back to Genesis chapter 4. But here, the child is pictured in authority over the created order, including the snakes. So I guess we've got a picture here, a symbolic picture of the reversal of the curse that Genesis 4 speaks so powerfully about. And the picture of the little child leading, I guess, revisits the whole thinking about how humanity was given rule over creation back in Genesis as well. These are just a remarkable set of images, aren't they, in these verses. And they hint at how this perfect world that this ruler will rule over is not unlike that of Eden that you can read of in Genesis, except without the fall. Well, if this is to be a perfect world, then not only must the created order be in harmony, but people must be reunited with the one true God. I guess we are witnesses today to the results of our striving for a better, if not perfect, world. And it does seem, doesn't it, that for every step forward we humans seem to make, we take two steps back. You know, just when we discover a cure for an illness that will save lives, a country will go and invade another country, commit genocide, and hundreds of thousands of people might die. We never seem to get it right. Why? Well, of course, there's lots of complex political and social reasons why these things happen, but going beyond those, very simply, of course, and oversimplifying it, is our rebellion against God. It's our desire to want to run everything our way and our insistence that we know what's best, and the desire to do what's best for me, for us, at the expense of other people. But in the perfect world described just so briefly in these verses, here, everything is going to focus upon God, not upon us. So according to verse 9, everyone will know God. Can you imagine that? In just that one statement, we've got an image of God's world that is just has so many implications for us. So many implications for us. What this ruler, who's described here in this chapter for us, has by the Spirit of God is going to be made available to all people one day. Just extraordinary. And the focus on all, if you like, continues from verse 10 up to the end of the chapter. Up to now, the emphasis has been on the raising up of a Jewish remnant, hasn't it? And that does continue in verses 11 through 16. But the scope of this new world order now expands out to include all nations. Verse 10. So even back here in Isaiah, we see God's grand plan of being spoken of again, just as he promised in Abraham when he said to Abraham, through you all nations will be blessed. So here in Isaiah, God reminds his people that his plan is to unite Jews and Gentiles, to include Australians and Americans and Slovakians and Malaysians and French people and whoever else you can think of, whether you think they deserve to be there or not. But to unite all people from everywhere. And again, we see this prophecy fulfilled in a number of ways. There were occasions in the Old Testament where the people of God, where Israel, were a blessing to the other nations around them. The times in their history when they did get their focus right. And so other countries, other nations looked upon them, and through looking upon them and seeing how they lived, they learned about the one true God. But of course, that promise to include all nations really sprang to life in the period that covers the book of Acts covers. And at Sunday Night Church, we're getting close to the end of a 26-week series on Acts. And we've been reminded just time and time again of how the gospel was taken to many nations and many people and how God gathered them together into his church. So, this perfect world that Isaiah speaks of will have all creation in harmony, all people in relationship with God, and the perfect ruler in authority over all. But how can we find this ruler? And what about us? Where do we fit into all of this? Well, the rest of the answer is partly, I guess, in the heading you've got at point five there, in that we are living in a period of time that, biblically speaking, we could call the now but not yet period. Bit of a clumsy title, but it sort of works. The rest of the answer will become clear as we jump into the New Testament. And hopefully by now you're getting used to seeing just how much Jesus appears in books like Isaiah. Because consider how Jesus fits the picture here. He was conceived by the Holy Spirit. He was baptized in the Spirit. He was led by the Spirit. And as he begins his public ministry, what does he do? He quotes Isaiah 61 in saying, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." See the connections? In Jesus' ministry, we see a taste of the perfect world to come as he calms storms, heals sick people, feeds hungry, rebukes oppressors, raises the dead, and forgives people their rebellion against God. All powerful statements, but primarily about who Jesus is, rather than just being dramatic pieces of theatre. And after his own death and resurrection, he is raised to God's right hand, and we're told, placed in authority over the universe. If you didn't get it already, as soon as you look at Jesus, you can see that he is the ruler of Isaiah 11. In fact, virtually every record of what Jesus did and spoke is a pointer for us. A pointer that on one hand invites us to look back to the Old Testament prophecies like Isaiah 11 and see God at work, preparing things. And on the other hand, directs us to a future time when King Jesus' reign will be recognized and acknowledged by all. And if you need any more prompting, John's vision that we have in the book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible, describes Jesus clearly as this promised perfect ruler. You've got some, a couple of quotes there on the back of your outlines you can look at. So we found our ruler. This is him. The Jesus that we sung about in our first song. Behold the Lamb of God. Behold God come to earth as a human being. As God's perfect ruler. So how are we to respond to him? Well, of course, the only legitimate, reasonable, acceptable response is to submit to him. Acknowledge our utter unworthiness of his rule over us and give our lives 100% to him. But we're left with a problem, aren't we? If Jesus is this perfect ruler, then why is the world in such a disastrous mess still? I mean, it's been 2,000 years. Why are there still wars and famines and droughts and floods? Why do people still die of preventable diseases? Why are people dying of brand new diseases that we didn't know anything about? Why is the world just so stuffed up? If God's done his thing, put his ruler in place? Well, the answer is simple, but complicated. We live in the time which has been described as the now, but not yet. That is, we exist now, Jesus having done his job, been placed in the role of ruler over all, but that rule is not yet totally fulfilled. And we're just plain impatient. I mean, 2,000 years, what's wrong with us? But we are. We need to take a step back and try again to see things from God's perspective. Jesus has finished his work. He has been placed as ruler over all. That happened at his ascension. But we wait for his return when the perfect world will be seen and experienced in all its magnificence. So we need to have patience. We need to wait. You know, the Athens Olympics are just weeks away, aren't they? Who's got their tickets? If I asked the same question 4 years ago, might have got a different response. Who had tickets to some of the big events at the Olympics? Anyone have tickets to some of the big ones? All right, even a small one. You can have a little count. Okay, yeah, that's right. I know. But do you remember the performance you had to go through to get those tickets? Remember, it was months and months and months before, wasn't it? In some cases, you had to go in for a ballot to get the ticket. And you had to pay up front, of course. You know, a lot of loaded up credit cards that year, wasn't there? And the year before. And all that you had, if you were successful in getting the ticket, all that you had was a bit of paper, or maybe even just an email, stating that you had the tickets, and they were going to be held and kept secure for you until the time was right. Until the time was right. And you had to wait a long time in hope for their delivery that would then allow you to experience the games in all their glory. Well, it's just like that for us now. We've got the guarantee of God's ruler in Jesus. We just need to wait for the big event, the final event, that will see God's world, God's perfect world, put in place, and his ruler, his perfect ruler, exercising his authority. You can read all about it in Romans 8 from 16 onwards, where Paul describes the creation itself waiting for this final revelation and speaks of the Spirit of God helping us in our weakness as we look forward to that day. But it will come, and we will see it if we keep ourselves in Jesus. But until it happens, our job is to push on, enduring in this very imperfect world, longing for the next, but all the while, until that happens, proclaiming the perfect ruler, Jesus, to all the nations. Amen.